This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It is Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And today, our entire hour will be devoted to that crucial topic. It's World COPD Day today, and it's become an annual tradition to devote some time to that. And that's what we will do starting at 12:30. But first, a number of stories about cancer. So a new report finds that cervical cancer rates have plateaued and are no longer declining, with one expert suggesting that Canada may not reach its goal of eliminating this disease by 2040. Eliminating the disease by 2040 is our goal. Meanwhile, possibly some good news for colon cancer patients. It seems that those breakthrough GLP-1 receptor drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy may offer a survival advantage for colon cancer patients who have obesity. We'll talk about that. And on the subject of cancer research, our toenail clippings could yield critical information about what causes lung cancer in non-smokers, and it leads back to radon gas, which occurs naturally in the environment. And here's something that we have not heard about for quite a while, and that is growing resistance to antibiotics. All of these important topics, the numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, former head of BC Cancer, Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto, and Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Libby.
Let us begin with this new warning from the World Health Organization about antibiotic resistance. I remember hearing a lot about it a few years back, but I thought maybe the problem was a bit solved because I hadn't heard anything, I think, for quite a long time, Jamie.
Yeah, it's always been a problem in my practice ever since I started, but definitely in the last years I've noticed, and we've noticed as a hospital, increased resistance. Thankfully, we're not as bad as places like the U.S., Europe, Asia, Africa, where the rates could be up to 70% resistance. And, you know, a million people a year die just because of drug resistance. So this is a problem we see every day. It's one of the things that I treat the most is infections or sepsis in the ICU. People come in with pneumonia, urine infections, gallbladder infections, other infections, skin infections. And we're definitely seeing an increased number of resistance to the drugs we rely on, like penicillins and drugs like that. So definitely increasing, and it's one of the things that, you know, we're running out of drugs, right? The drug resistance that's happening in the world to antibiotic resistance is outpacing new drugs that we are developing to fight these infections.
Elisa, is it just a matter that these drugs are overprescribed and perhaps not appropriately prescribed?
That's one of the big problems, is that people will come in and they will assume that their sore throat is strep and they request to go on antibiotics, or they've been sick with a sinus infection for a couple of days and they want antibiotics as well. So a lot of it becomes in terms of education and explaining to people that most likely what they have are viral infections and that we shouldn't be treating and we should be waiting. Another big problem is with urinary tract infections. The more and more infections that people get, the more and more resistance. And it actually becomes a problem that even I, as a family doctor, have to deal with, that there'll be increasing resistance towards the drugs. And so then it becomes an issue of really taking the time to figure out, should a urine test be ordered based on their symptoms? So that's a big issue. But then overall, probably, people do have to consider that there's other reasons why we have antibiotic resistance. And some of it has to do with agriculture and giving antibiotics to animals like cows and stuff. And so it's really, we're part of the problem, but also there's a bigger problem as well.
Malcolm, does this sort of trickle down into the cancer space?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the reason hospitals are dangerous places is, in particular cancer hospitals, is we have to use a lot of antimicrobials, antibiotics, because patients are sick and vulnerable to infectious diseases. And when you do that, inevitably what happens is that you're still going to end up with bacteria, but these bacteria tend to be resistant to the standard antibiotics that we use. And so, MRSA, and there's VRSA, there's lots of different organisms now that are resistant to a lot of the standard antibiotics. One of the interesting things is that, it's not like this is new information. We've known this for 20 years. But there has not been a lot of new antibiotics developed over the past 20 years, I would say. This was an area of rapid growth in terms of getting new antibiotics. But for some reason, over the last 10 to 20 years, very few new antibiotics have been introduced into the marketplace. So we're still trying to deal with the existing infections with the same tools we had 10 or 15 years ago.
Is it possible, Jamie, that very few antibiotics, new ones, have been developed because other types of drugs are more lucrative? And what do you give people when you find that they have a resistant infection?
No, you're exactly right. And that's well known that antibiotics are not as lucrative as GLP-1s or statins or drugs that people use their whole life, day in and day out, right? Antibiotics are things that we use for 5 to 7 days usually. So it's not as lucrative for drug companies to develop these drugs. So that's clearly one of the major reasons why we don't have new antibiotics developing down the pipeline. So a lot of governments are trying they realize this, and they're trying to fund these new antibiotics. And in terms of if a patient comes in, and for example, right now in the ICU at our hospital, we have this patient who's been chronically unwell, has been in ICUs and chronic facilities for years, and he has pneumonia and he has significant resistance to the bacteria that he has in his lungs. And we really don't have any antibiotics to really fight this bacteria. And we're trying to, give him antibiotics that we know he's resistant to, and hopefully there's some effect. But and we're seeing this more and more in these chronic patients that have had multiple infections and multiple antibiotics. So there are some tools that we're using in the hospital. For example, we're trying to use in the ICU, and one of the standard things is to use chlorhexidine or mouth rinse, so that reduces the amount of infection or pneumonia generally that you could get in the ICU. So we use chlorhexidine mouth rinse in all our patients. We use chlorhexidine baths every day on all our patients to reduce infection as well from the skin. So these are things that we're trying to do universally that have had some effect on reducing infections, but there's definitely cases where they develop a pneumonia or a urine infection or a blood infection, and we don't have any significant tools, and we're using very expensive new drugs. There are a couple of new drugs that we do have access to that have improved sensitivities to these some of the old resistant bacteria that we're seeing, but they're very expensive. They're something like $2,000 to $3,000 a day.
Wow.
as opposed to penicillin, where penicillin's like I think it's like something like $10 to $20 to up to $50, depending which one, a day. So these new drugs are quite expensive.
Yeah, and the other ones are quite cheap. Malcolm, I remember with great fanfare this announcement that we were going to eliminate cervical cancer. Part of it was because of the HPV vaccines, and now there's a study that says, well, actually, maybe not.
Yeah, well, part of the possible, right? So what we know is that we have the tools. With a combination of vaccination and proper screening, with the new HPV screening, we should be able to pretty much eliminate cervical cancer. I mean, one of the troubling things is that there are certain parts of the world, Africa, et cetera, where these measures just aren't in place at all, and you still see a very high rate of what's essentially a preventable disease. But the reality is, whenever you have a program like this, there are people who fall through the cracks, who don't get vaccinated, don't get screened. And, you know, we've talked about this before, the HPV vaccine, which is now widely available and funded throughout the country, still the uptake rates in terms of parents getting their I think it's grade 7 when they get vaccinated, is still not super high. And it seems like the further west in Canada you go, the lower the vaccinations rates are. So that obviously is going to put some of those people at risk for getting cervical cancer.
Alisa, what have you seen in your practice in terms of parents making sure their kids get the vaccine? And is it, if there's a drop, is it part of the usual vaccine hesitancy we talked about? Or I know that certain people think that getting the vaccine, you know, abets promiscuity or sexual activity or whatever.
So when the program first became available, I think it was probably in the mid-2000s, that was a big concern that parents would have specifically. And at that time, the program was only available for vaccination of HPV for females. Later on, it became available to both females and males. But at that time, there was some concern by some parents that one, their child didn't need it, and two, that maybe that they would then become sexually active at an earlier age or have be sexually active with more partners. That I don't find to be a main issue now. I think that there's probably been, in terms of vaccinations, that Gardasil, which is the vaccine that's available in Canada for HPV, there seems to be good uptake amongst the patients in terms of vaccinating their children, and it's through the school. The issue usually comes sometimes children don't like to have it at school. It's a little bit of a painful shot, and then it becomes trying to figure out, well, how are we going to get the vaccine? And so that adds in a layer of complexity that one doesn't need to exist, but then usually, you know, they have to come to see me to get the vaccine. So usually that's now the pushback, is that they just don't want their child to have it at school, or the child doesn't want to have it at school. They feel more comfortable having it for me. They know me. But in terms of uptake, it's usually not been an issue anymore. And what we'll do is for when somebody will have an abnormal pap smear or they're HPV positive now and they didn't have the vaccine because they're older, we'll go ahead and we'll offer it to them and say, listen, it's probably good for you to be vaccinated now. It might help your body in terms of the immune response, and there are still other viruses, other strains of the virus that you can get. And usually there is a very good uptake in that situation for people wanting to get the vaccine. So I think maybe because of the link with cancer, this is probably one of the vaccines that people will be more willing to get than other vaccines.
Well, that's good. That's always good to hear. Excuse me. Speaking of cancer, this is a positive thing. So, you know, we always hear with new drugs, particularly these new GLP-1 drugs, of potential other uses and other benefits they can confer. So, Malcolm, for colon cancer, now it looks like they may have a survival advantage for colon cancer patients who are obese.
Yeah, this is a very interesting study. I wasn't able to access the full study, just the abstract, but the one caveat I would have is this was not published in kind of a first-rate journal, so there may be some methodological issues, but it's a very interesting finding, and it's a striking difference between the people who were on GLP-1 and those who were not in terms of recurrence of their pre-existing colon cancer. And, you know, there is some science to all of this. I mean, it aligns with a lot of other data we're getting on colon cancer. We know that obesity is a risk factor for the disease. We know that there's this rising incidence of colon cancer in younger people, which we're not 100% sure, but we think it's related to consumption of ultra-processed foods, which again are associated with obesity. And then there was this interesting study we talked about a few weeks ago where exercise after surgery for colon cancer seems to reduce the risk of the cancer coming back. So obviously metabolism is important. So this is a really interesting finding, and I suspect what we're going to see is you're going to see some high-quality studies being done of this, probably even randomized studies where patients are randomized between GLP-1 or no GLP-1 after surgery and chemotherapy for colon cancer. And if the magnitude of the difference is even close to what is shown in this study, this will be an important advance.
And, Jamie, the patents are coming off some of these drugs, which are extremely expensive. Thank goodness, not as expensive as they are in the United States, but that may all change soon.
Yeah, and it was actually a mistake by the company, Novo Nordisk, where they forgot to file the extension patent for Ozempic in Canada only. So on January 1st, 2026, it's coming off patent. So what I'm going to guess is in January 2026, you're going to see a lot of Ozempic or Ozempic-like advertising clinics come to us. We have really cheap Ozempic, so I think you'll see a lot of advertising of it in early 2026. So, and I think it's going to benefit us and in terms of, you know, access to it, because right now it's really expensive. It's somewhere between $300 and $500 a month, right? And that's quite expensive for just one drug, when usually you're on multiple drugs if Ozempic's just one of them. So, or we'll go V. So, I think this is one instance where the drug company messed up, and the public's going to benefit from it in 2026 in Canada alone.
I heard something, I forget exactly what it was, that the price of it is coming down in the States to some Trump thing. Do you think, Alisa, that because of this right now, in terms of getting coverage in Canada, it's only for people who are diabetic? So do you think that might be expanded if the drug is cheaper?
So semaglutide is approved for diabetes, and that's known as Ozempic. And then semaglutide at higher doses is also approved by Health Canada for weight loss, which is Wegovy. So it's very confusing. So semaglutide is going generic in January. And what I think it will do is hopefully it will help in two different ways. One, maybe there'll be third-party coverage. So more and more plans are starting to cover Wegovy for weight loss as the indication. So maybe more third-party plans will pick it up, and that will allow more access to people who have third-party coverage. And at the same time, it will help people who don't have third-party coverage, who they'll be able to afford it because the price of it will become significantly down. The other problem that happens is that, as we just discussed with colon cancer and with GLP-1s, that there's more and more applications and benefits that are being found, irrespective of if you have diabetes or if you have weight loss, in terms of, you know, for knee pain, and the benefit in terms of for kidney function and heart function and all of these things. And even though something might be shown to be of benefit, drug companies still won't cover it. So I'm hoping now, because you're going to see there's going to be an explosion of drugs by every drug company who will be in this class and related classes, because they're just finding such big benefits of the drug, that hopefully this will allow, that it will expand coverage, because right now even third-party companies, they'll restrict access to it, even though that there could be a Health Canada approved indication for it. So this will open up the market and allow people to be able to afford it who who wouldn't be able to as of now.
What about, we've talked before about your patients who really shouldn't take it, who only want to lose a few pounds. Is it going to open the floodgates of people who want to take it, who maybe don't really need to be on it?
So that's a whole other problem, and that continues. So people will come in very often and be like, I just need to lose 10 pounds. I need you to give me the drug. My friend is getting it. Why won't you give it to me? If you don't give it to me, I'll get it somewhere else. And I think you're going to see that. And sometimes cost will be a barrier. And then it's a matter of explaining to people, hey, this drug is not a 10 pound lose the weight and then you're fine. This is, once you stop it, you're going to regain the weight back. So this is sort of a lifelong commitment. But there is such a push now, especially within social media and with people being thin and seeing all of these famous people who've lost significant amount of weight, that there is such a push for people to want to be on the drug. And I've talked before in terms of that there's these online providers, and I've had patients who've gone to these online providers where you pay a fee and you basically will get the drug. I then find out about it as an after fact because usually something happened. But it's actually quite shocking how easy it is to get the drug. If you want it, you can go and you can pay and be able to find somebody who will prescribe it to you.
Okay. Finally, this incredible story, Malcolm, about using toenail clippings to measure radon gas, which is apparently a cause of lung cancer in people who don't smoke.
Okay, well, very quickly, because I know we're almost out of time. First of all, people should not, you know, radon gas is radioactive. This does not mean your toenails are radioactive. The reason they can use toenails is that radon degrades to lead, and so what they're doing with the toenails is they're measuring lead. And toenails have been used for environmental exposure for quite a while. They basically measure exposure over the past 6 to 12 months. That's how long it takes toenails to grow and then eventually have to be cut off. So it is used for some sorts of environmental exposure. Whether these people in Calgary can really do what they say they do, which is talking about measuring it over the last 15 years, I'm a bit more skeptical of that. And it's a relatively crude measure because there's so much variability in how quickly people's nails grow, how old they are, other diseases they have, do they have nail fungus. So I'm skeptical that this is going to lead to any sort of major cancer breakthrough, to be honest.
Uh-huh. It is, like, it sounded sort of way out there when I was reading about it.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so, don't hold off on that mani-pedi, I guess. Okay, I am looking at the clock, so may as well wrap things up on that note. Thank you so much, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, and Dr. Malcolm Moore, and we'll talk again soon. Bye.
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 Okay. We are taking a break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about World COPD Day, and we've talked about it annually for the last few years, and we always get a lot of calls because this is not a disease we hear a lot about, but it certainly affects a lot of people. And it turns out a lot of people may be walking around with it and have no idea. So before we head into the break, let me give the numbers out so you can jot it down if you are going to have any questions. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And also, if you're suffering with it or if you have a loved one, very interested in hearing your story, your experience of this. And we will do that on the other side of the break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. And we are now getting to our special coverage of World COPD Day. That is, congestive obstructive pulmonary disease. Was I no?
No, it's chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
I was saying that all morning, and I just had a little brain clog in there. So I apologize for that, people. See, even I can have a lot to learn about this. And 2 million Canadians have been diagnosed with this affliction. And according to the experts, another million could unknowingly have it. And the key is to manage it properly. And I am here with Henry Roberts, who is a member of the executive committee and a co-founder of the Chronic Obstructive Pulmonary Disease Association. And I am going to give the numbers out again, because if you have a story to share, if you or a loved one suffers with it, or if you have questions, well, we're here with Henry, and he's the right guy to talk to. The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll-free, 1-866-740-4740. And Henry, some little-known true facts about COPD. I was shocked that more than a quarter of people over the age of 85 have it. I mean, how? Why?
Well, most people who have COPD were smokers. And if you look at our membership, our members range in age, most of them, between 65 and 85. Now, if you grew up in the 50s and 60s and 70s in Canada and around the world, quite frankly, everybody smoked. It was cool to smoke. Hollywood was complicit. They made it glamorous. Women smoked with cigarette holders, and it was everywhere. You could smoke in theaters. You could smoke on airplanes. I like to refer people to Mad Men. I grew up in the publishing communications world, dealing with ad agencies. We could smoke in the office. We drank in the office. We worked hard. We played harder. And that group of people are now aged. And a lot of them are sick. They ignored the warning signs of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. The big ones are breathlessness and not being able to do things you used to be able to do. And smokers in particular obfuscate their symptoms. They don't want to be forced to quit smoking. They also blame their breathlessness on being out of shape or being old. And we have a dearth of testing. Common test is a spirometry test, and it's just not available everywhere across the country. And that creates this bubble of people who have COPD are in denial, but there's no access to the testing. Hmm. So here we are.
And COPD is the second leading cause of hospitalization. That is a surprise to me.
Yeah, repeat hospitalizations. What happens is people will have these extreme episodes of breathlessness called an exacerbation or a flare-up. And they just can't breathe. So they'll end up calling an ambulance, going to emergency. They'll be stabilized in emergency and then kind of sent on their way with prednisone and an antibiotic. So there really are no protocols that all of the emergency rooms across the country follow. So you get people who are released. They haven't really been normalized at the moment. But the root cause of their exacerbation has not really been dealt with. They might be on medicines that are not strong enough. The therapies for COPD, they refer to them as stepped-up therapies. You're started on long-acting bronchodilators or things called anti-mucociliary agents, which open up the airways. And it's a progressive disease, so you're getting worse and worse and worse as time goes on. So the medicines are increased in the potency and the types of medicines. So you'll go from a double therapy to a triple therapy. And those are fairly new. There are two out there now. One's called Trelegy and the other's called Breztri. And in the last couple of weeks, a new biologic has been approved called Dupixent. And there's another one that's coming down the pipe very quickly called Nucala. Those are from big companies, Sanofi and GSK. And those that therapy will be added to the triple therapy. They're very potent anti-inflammatory drugs. So there are ways in which you can avoid having exacerbations. Every time someone ends up in hospital with an exacerbation, they never come out as well as when they went in. They always come out worse.
Okay, let's take a call from Shauna in Mississauga. Hello, Shauna.
Hello, Libby. First-time caller.
I owe you a bell, Shauna. Thank you. Oh, somebody moved it. Okay.
Shame on them.
Shame on them.
So.
Okay, well, you got a pathetic shadow of a bell, but please, Shauna, go ahead.
My husband died 3 years ago from COPD.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yes, he was 70 when he was diagnosed. He was on oxygen for 6 years. He, as the gentleman said, was in complete denial. He just didn't believe it, and he was a pot smoker as well. So he went without doing any therapy or anything, and then it was one day he couldn't breathe, and we rushed him to the hospital. His oxygen level dropped to 70%, and exasperated everything. And from then on, he was on oxygen constant. We had it running through our house. He had a portable transport, like oxygen tank. Probably 5 months prior to of 22 in May, and he was on the strongest drugs. And Trilogy does ring a bell. He was on absolutely every therapy possible. He did exercises. Unfortunately, when we saw the respiratory doctor in May of 22, he said to Wayne, please get your affairs in order.
So sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's a very typical story that people are diagnosed and they're already in stage 3 or stage 4 COPD. And how these stages have been developed is, it's through an organization called GOLD, but it's basically they measure how forcefully you can exhale. And your forced expiratory volume, like an FEV1, if you exhale at 80% of the rate a person who's the same sex, height, and age, they would give you a stage 1 score. If your FEV was between 50 and 79%, as forceful as a healthy person, you'd be in stage 2. When people most go to the doctors, they're in stage 3, and that means you're typically between 30 and 50%. You can exhale at that rate. And then stage 4 is under 30%, and at that point, you almost always go on supplemental oxygen. Now, the thing with COPD is that, you know, if you can be caught at stage 1 and stage 2, there are very, very good medicines. There's also, especially in downtown Toronto and most of the urban areas, there's access to pulmonary rehab. Pulmonary rehab teaches you how to breathe. They teach you how to do pursed lip breathing to avoid exacerbating. They train you how to breathe from the diaphragm. As we get older, we breathe shallowly through our lungs. If you look a little baby, you see their belly rising. They're completely breathing from the diaphragm. So we have to retrain ourselves to do this diaphragmic breathing. All of that is learned at pulmonary rehab. All of that is available if you're diagnosed early and the respirologist refers you to these rehab facilities.
Shauna, thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm sorry to hear about what happened to your husband. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll talk a little bit more about early diagnosis when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, I am here with Henry Roberts to mark World COPD Day. And before the break, we heard from Shauna, who told us about her husband who passed away from COPD 3 years ago. And he was diagnosed at a very late stage. So before we get to that, let me give the numbers out again. Henry is a fabulous resource for questions about this disease. There are new drugs that he's already been talking about. And we also want to hear your stories. The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And Henry, why are people diagnosed late as opposed to early?
Well, they're ignoring the early signs of COPD, namely breathlessness is the big one. And because a lot of them are ex-smokers or current smokers, they're just not revealing their symptoms to their doctors. Doctors also don't have don't have availability of spirometry testing. There's a dearth of it in the country, and without the spirometry testing, you can't get the diagnosis. Without the diagnosis, you can't get the medicine.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
So why is it? I think I've had one of those for other reasons, but it didn't seem like it was that complicated a test.
It's not. You blow into a little tube and you take a deep breath in and you blow it as hard as you can. And that expiratory volume is compared to someone your age, same sex, same height, I believe. And if the test determines that you're exhaling at 50% of the rate of the normal population of people like you, they know something's wrong. And you mentioned a lot of people will go for lung function tests if they have a different kind of surgery coming up. It's a typical test as a kind of a screening test to make sure you can handle the surgery.
Okay, let's go to Joan in Caledon. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Libby. Just turn off my radio. I've spoken with you a couple times in the past, and I appreciate you taking my call. I just lost my brother-in-law September 1st. With
sorry to hear that.
On my mom's birthday, and he lost his wife just under 5 months prior to his death with a lung disease. She had ILD, interstitial lung disease. Now they both went very, very, very badly. I was in hospital with both of them when they were passing. It's very, very terrible to watch them not being able to breathe, as I'm hearing with your show. They just cry out for breath of air, and very, very sad. So I thought I would pass that along, and we're still suffering with their loss.
Of course.
It's been terrible. Yeah. And I myself, Libby, have had 4 cancers.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
And I'm still, listen, I believe I can be as strong as yourself. I watched your show the other night.
Oh, thank you.
As I do when I hear on the radio that you've got a show on TV coming on, I make sure I watch it, and I just love them. They're very interesting. But I've had 3 breast cancer, 1 uterine cancer, and I've had a double mastectomy.
Wow.
So it's just, and I will be 80 in February.
Well, congrats on that.
Big birthday
to celebrate.
I experienced a similar type thing. A very good friend of mine was diagnosed with emphysema, and I watched her go from diagnosis to death over a number of years, and the decline in the person's abilities and the bouts of breathlessness, and you can't go to restaurants if there are any stairs that you have to deal with. It's a very, very serious condition, and I can't impress upon you enough that if you're experiencing breathlessness, go to the doctor, insist on getting a lung function test, and hopefully it'll be a spirometry test. And, well, hopefully you don't have COPD, but if you do, you got to get to it quickly.
Joan, thanks so much for sharing your story. Let's go to Stephen in Toronto. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, good. Go ahead, Stephen.
I'm going to turn it up here. Just give me 2 seconds. Yes, I have pulmonary fibrosis and emphysema. And I'm on Trilogy. I'm also on oxygen. But I find that there's a disconnect, or at least I think there is, between the amount of oxygen I get and my ability to breathe easier.
Well, you're on the maximum kind of therapy with the Trilogy and supplemental oxygen.
Right. I'm on oxygen. I'm in the car. I'm on oxygen as we're talking. I have my.
I think I could hear something.
Yeah. Do you have to fiddle with the rate, like at a 3 or a 5 or 6 or?
Well, I'm at sort of 4 or 5 if I'm sitting down. 4. If I have to move, I'm up to 6, and now it could be 7 shortly.
And how long does the last oxygen, the portable oxygen, last for you?
Well, I have it plugged into the car outlet here, but if I'm using it without any plug-in, it's probably an hour and a half.
Yeah, and just getting back to your not being able to breathe in spite of the fact that you're on the triple therapy and the oxygen, I really don't know what to say about that. Are you at stage 4? Have they told you?
No, I'm stage 3 pulmonary fibrosis, evidently, so I've been told.
Yeah, it may have to do with the scarring. The pulmonary fibrosis is the scarring of the lungs, right? And the emphysema is the destruction of the air sac. So there might be an interplay between the two that I'm not a doctor, so.
No, I realize that. I've just started to notice that. Where I'm on oxygen, then I get up and I sort of walk around and I get out of breath.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of not gasping for air, but certainly trying to get some air.
Well, you have to be very aware of what the weather is like, and also to stay away from toxins or airborne particulates. If they're, I don't know where you are, but if there are forest fires.
I'm in Toronto, and the damp weather just makes it so much worse.
Yeah, that's pretty common, and many of our members can't go outside if it's too hot or if it's too cold. We used to have pollution index that was available through an app, but it has disappeared. I think it was.
I haven't found it. I used to look for it, but I can't find it anymore.
Yeah, it was invented in Calgary, and Alberta shared it with the rest of the company. And about a year and a half ago, they pulled it from Ontario.
Stephen, all the best to you, and
I
hope that you're able to manage your COPD. And all the best to you. First of all, a small program note, people. There's apparently going to be an alert ready test at 12:55, which is coming up in about 4.5 minutes. So obviously, we're not going to talk over that. Henry, I want to get to these up to a million people who are living with COPD but are unaware. Like, why is it so underdiagnosed? Is it again because of that spirometry test, or is it because people are in denial?
I think it's a combination of both. You can't I was on a Zoom call the other day with a respirologist from Northern Quebec, and she wanted to give her patient spirometry testing. It's just wasn't available, which is shocking. And also a lot of doctors, family doctors, will send the patient to a respirologist because they don't know how to use the spirometry machine and they don't know how to interpret the results. So there are a couple of doctors, Dr. Chris Lexi in Hamilton and a respirologist, Madonna Ferrone, who've written clinical papers on the efficiency of having certified respiratory educators in large clinics so that doctors can send people to these certified respiratory educators who are experts at interpreting the results. It would also free the doctors up from the paperwork and that involvement so they could spend more time with patients. So there are solutions out there. It's just the will of the healthcare systems and different provincial governments.
Yeah, it's again, it's odd because I wouldn't imagine that it's something that's expensive, but what do I know? I am going to take a quick call that hopefully we can get in before that alert. We've got Stephen Brampton. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Libby. A quick question for your guest. I was diagnosed with moderate COPD a few years ago. I have just two of the basic inhalers, which I hardly ever use. My father actually had emphysema, and I also am a trypsin, alpha trypsin. It's with me. But nobody has suggested to me that I should be on any further treatment at this time, and I'm just trying to reconcile that with some of your earlier comments.
Okay, well, it seems to me that the medicines that you do have are managing well. The alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is a completely different ball of wax. It's about 5% of COPDers who have that. There is an Alpha-1 Canada. There's an association where you can get lots and lots of good information from them. There's a therapy that was provided that was then withdrawn, and now it's back available after, you know, tremendous lobbying by Alpha Canada and Dr. Ken Chapman. So I would suggest to go there and to get more information.
Okay, Steve, thanks for your call. I'm looking. I mean, people, don't be alarmed if we are interrupted by that ready test of the alert system, because according to my notes, it's coming up really soon and hopefully won't last too long. And we can come back after that before we wrap up at one. As with other things, I'm imagining that, you know, you want to be managed on the lightest drug combo possible.
Right, exactly. And, you know, this the therapies are what they refer to as stepped-up therapies. So they start you on a LAM, it's a long-acting anti-muscarin agent, and then you'll progress to a long-acting bronchodilator. And then as you get worse, they will add the two together. You'll be on a LAMA-LABA. There are a bunch of different products that have those ingredients. And then they will, if that's still not working, they'll add an inhaled corticosteroid. They're called ICS. So you'd be on a LAMA-LABA and an ICS. That's, and it's oftentimes you would have three different inhalers for those therapies. And then the pharmaceutical industry started to combine them, and we ended up with that combination, the triple therapy that one of our earlier callers talked about.
Okay, I'm seeing it sounds like the alert is on the phone, not on the radio, at least not at this moment. That's good news for us. Are there side effects to these treatments?
Well, there are. Yeah, especially the corticosteroids, some of them it's suspected that they can bring on or make you more susceptible to pneumonia. There's also the chemicals themselves can cause thrush. The friend I was referring to was accidentally taking a double dose, so she was experiencing bleeding in her mouth. There's a lot of bruising that becomes apparent to people on the corticosteroids. So there's serious medicines. And most people also have a rescue inhaler, which is a short-acting bronchodilator. And a lot of people call them the blue puffers because of the packaging of the medicine. And those are used if you're, you know, suddenly you have a extreme bout of breathlessness, you can use this rescue inhaler.
Mm-hmm. And any other side effects that people should know about?
Well, they're all kinds of things that, you know, you could add that increased mucus production and gastro issues of different sorts, but
there are a lot of, I mean, I'm sure that this makes it a lot harder to do any kind of exercise and movement, but if you're able to, is there exercise that helps the condition?
Yeah, there are people, a lot of people believe in things like Tai Chi and any kind of movement, smooth movement. As I mentioned before, the pulmonary rehab have full programs of exercises that people with COPD, regardless of the stage, can participate in. And that could be a bicycle movement. As I mentioned before, breathing exercises like pursed lip breathing, which is a very, very effective way of retraining your lungs. There are movements with the arms and with the legs and, you know, sitting in chair movements where, you know, it's not too stressful on the body because people are very compromised. I like the Lung Association slogan that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, a real truism.
It is absolutely a real truism. What would you recommend for people who are newly diagnosed or have a loved one who's newly diagnosed? Should they get in touch with your association, and how do they do that?
Well, we have a very robust website. We're at www.copdcanada.info. On the occasion of World COPD Day, we've launched what I think is an excellent patient education tool called Living with COPD. It's packed with information. It's free to download. You just go to the website, copdcanada.info, and you'll see a headline, patient education. Click on that, and it'll give you access to this brochure, which walks you through, I've got a copy of it in front of me, just practical tips, assessing my COPD, assessing the symptoms, taking a breath assessment test, treating the different type of treatments that are available, avoiding flare-ups, explaining what they are and then avoiding them. Then it has my COPD checklist, which is a list of questions to take in. You can cut it out and take it into your doctor, and it'll walk you through the questions to ask your doctor. So a lot of people have the best intention to ask, but then they can't remember what they were going to ask.
That's pretty common.
Yeah. And then there's a page on understanding the medications, how to use your inhalers, and so on and so forth. So patient education on our website, and it'll explain.
Okay, well, we're at the end of our time here, and we got through without being interrupted by that alert, so that's good news. Thank you so much for a very informative discussion about a disease that, most people are just not aware of. So it's World COPD Day, and thank you so much, Henry Roberts.
Thank you very much for having me. It was nice.
Okay. That's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram. I will be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.